This is Lisa Smith Henderson, your host for Teens Talk Truth, and this program deals with the topic of suicide and depression. I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Stephen Priest, whom I've known for many years, interviewed in the past, and I'm just so delighted you could be here with us today.
Glad to be here.
Can I give a few tidbits about Dr. Priest? He's, and may I call you Stephen when we start the interview?
Of course.
He's been practicing psychiatry for over 25 years, and he has many accolades to his credit. However, the thing that I think is most pertinent for this show, he's a past president of the Georgia Society for Adolescent Psychiatry, and in February of 2000, Dr. Priest was honored to be named Psychiatrist of the Year by the Georgia Psychiatric Physicians Association.
That was an honor.
Wow. That's really impressive. I'm just so delighted you could be with us today because hopefully someone is going to be able to save their teen from taking a wrong turn by hearing this.
That's my hope, too.
What I would like to know, if you can maybe enlighten us a little bit, why are we seeing teen suicide on the rise?
Well, it's got to be a lot of answers, but I would suspect that it's both good news and bad news. One, I suspect that the pressures that teens are exposed to today is greater than what we used to experience ourselves and the people and the generations before us, so that leads to a greater difficulty. The other side is good news. Parents are better at identifying problems. They have been educated by Dr. Phil and all the people who, like you, who are doing this kind of work, and they're able to spot difficulties sooner, so that we're catching difficulties sooner and identifying problems sooner. So it's both good and bad.
Could you put a myth or not a myth to rest, in your opinion, about Prozac being causing suicide attempts or concluding in suicide for teens?
Prozac will, of course, tell you, and they're correct, that nobody has ever proved that that's ever been true. I am old enough to know that this is actually old news. When I began my training, one of the keys was when you first start somebody on antidepressants, long before Prozac ever came on the market, you have to watch them when you're first treating them because you will give them enough energy but not enough recovery that they go through a window of a dangerous period where they'll still be sad enough and maybe even still thinking about suicide, but now they've got the energy because of the treatment to act on their thoughts and feelings.
So really what was keeping them from suiciding before was they were too lethargic,
absolutely.
Too depressed.
They were too depressed to mobilize, to activate their thoughts and feelings. And one of the risks is for some people and in some brains, that part will get changed before the depression gets changed. And when that happens, you have to watch for their impulsivity. So we knew that long ago. I think we're just rediscovering what we knew long ago. We went through a period where we thought we have these new medications, they'll solve everything. We don't have to watch them as close, take this and, you know, see you later. And that's not true.
What, and I would like for you to explain a little bit to us about the teenage brain. How, I mean, I know lately some of this has been coming more into the mainstream news, that teens' brains aren't really formed fully yet and that they don't form completely till they're 25. And how does this impact teen suicide?
If you are more motivated, if you have poor impulse control because you're smart enough to think of things, but you're not mature enough to not act on them. To not act on them means having the judgment to say, hold still, it'll be okay, the kind of judgment that we now have to know that things will be better. They're not old enough to know things will be better. You'll get over this. They don't know that. They're not old enough to have had lived long enough to know that you can get through this. So they panic at whatever stressor, think it's not worth it anymore. And if they're too impulsive still, then they can make bad decisions, whether it's driving or suicide or drugs, any other kind of risk-taking. I think it's an element of all the different ways that people mature. Nobody follows exactly the same path. Some brains are better at controlling their impulses first, and so they can then hold still and mature after that. Some of them are mature enough to sense stressors and worry about the future before they have impulse control, and they'd be the most at risk. Impulse control happens in your front brain, and for lots of different reasons, that region can develop differently. One of the greatest risk factors is drugs and alcohol. The first thing alcohol does is go to your frontal lobes and wipe out your inhibitions, so you order another drink. And then the second thing is, you know, that's why people dance on pianos and shoot each other, is their inhibitions are gone. The part of their brain that says, don't do this. That's why alcohol makes people drive too fast. They are risk takers. If you talk to some of the World War II aces, they'll admit, they were drinking a lot, and that's why they didn't mind getting in those planes and going and doing some of the heroic things they did. So alcohol and drugs affect cerebral maturity, and that's a great risk factor. Any kind of brain damage, meningitis, head trauma, car crashes, much less child abuse, if it damages, however slightly, those frontal lobes, then you have a child who is more impulsive. And there are treatments for this, and there are chemical as well as behavioral treatments for this. But there's a risk there that if you have someone who's more impulsive, then once they start having the normal worries that any adolescent would, they're just going to be more impulsive in what they do.
I know that girls attempt suicide more than boys, but it seems like boys complete it more. What do we see in the gender differences here? Are girls looking for help more?
Oh, I think it's entirely hormones. You know, women take more in. They're just better at doing this. And boys are more singular-minded. Testosterone makes people aggressive. That's why we have more aggressive sports. I hate to use sweeping generalizations and not be politically correct, but there are more aggressive sports for boys than there are for girls.
Right.
And so boys choose more aggressive means. It's harder to recover from a gunshot wound than it is an overdose. Boys just will tend to do more aggressive things that are harder to live through.
So it's not like they're really more clear about wanting to kill themselves. It's just the methods they choose are more difficult to come back from?
I think so, and I think those methods are based on hormone.
I think many of us are aware of the classic signs of danger, but I think it would be important to go over these.
Sure.
Kids that are talking about death or talking about wanting to kill themselves.
Right. That's a very clear sign. And if you're talking about it, you're thinking about it. If you're thinking about it, you've had a thought, you've had a feeling, rather, that has led you to that, which is usually one of the signs of depression. And you need to be aware not only of active talk about suicide, but passive talk about suicide. To say, oh, I feel like killing myself is pretty active and pretty clear.
Right.
To have someone say, I'm not sure it's worth it anymore, is a very passive way of saying that they're thinking that it's not worth going on.
The hopelessness.
Yeah, exactly. The hopelessness, helplessness, worthlessness kind of expression. And you need to say, well, what are you talking about? You need to ask about that. So active and passive talk, and this can be picked up by a parent, a coach, a teacher, a friend. Never get left holding the bag. If you're worried, tell somebody. This is not a secret to keep. So teens need to know that about their peers. Somebody's talking about this, and they say, now, don't tell anybody.
Right.
You tell them right up front, I ain't keeping that a secret. I'm telling right now. Either you tell them or I tell them, because I'm not going to sit on this. If I love you too much, and I'm not going to be the one that feels the most guilty because you did something and I didn't come forward with this news. So tell somebody and talk about it and approach it. And directness invites directness.
So it's okay to say, are you thinking about suicide when you talk like that?
It is more than okay. It's imperative.
Because I think so many people are afraid, oh, if I ask about it, I'm going to influence them to do it.
They've already thought about it or they wouldn't have said it. Some says, I'm not sure it's worth it anymore. Then the response is, well, you're not thinking about suicide, are you? And you just ask them. And if you get a dead silence, that's a yes. Or it's enough of a silence to make you, it's not a no. So, and even if you get a no, they still were passively hopeless. Decide right then that you're going to do more.
And I guess before we go through the other signs, I'd like to know, as a parent, when your child does say something to this effect, like they say, oh, I just thought about, taking a bottle of pills. I don't know what to do. Do you right then say, I'm taking you to the hospital? Do you call a therapist? What is the appropriate course of action?
More. The answer is more. Don't stop there. Keep going. Keep tiptoeing in and waiting in until you get an answer. What do you mean? Well, come on, look, you can't expect to say something like that and have me not want to know more. I want to know more. Look, if you're not going to talk to me, I want you to talk to somebody else. Look, if you're not going to talk to somebody else, then you have to know that I'm going to be on pins and needles until I know you're okay. Please, search for the words. Write me a letter. But I'm afraid to even leave you right now if you're going to talk like that. Be very clear about it. No, I'm not going to work. I'm staying right here, and you're not going to school until something happens that I know you're okay. Always do more. And then if they continue to reveal more and more signs, which are the fact that they maybe have thought about this before, have been thinking about it for a long time, that they actually have detailed plan. Yeah, I knew exactly what I was going to do. I know where Dad keeps his gun, and I know how to load them. I mean, they've thought through it all.
Right.
I know where you keep your medicines. I know which ones are safe and which ones aren't. I've looked it up on the web, and I know which ones will kill people. I mean, they've investigated. If they're getting deeper and deeper and deeper into their thinking about it, then you need to follow that string right back into the cave with them and get greater and greater levels of help. Look, this scares me. We're going to the emergency room right now, and we're going to sit there till somebody sees you. We're going to the psychiatric hospital right now. No, Mom, no, Dad, I'm not going to, you know, look, I'm not going to lose you. I love you too much. You just have to be very direct and confrontive. Okay, I promise I won't do anything. Well, okay, maybe, but still, I'm going to take a day off from work, and you're going to take a day off from school. We're going to go sit still. We're going fishing. We're going to do something till we've had a chance to talk with this more, and I really am convinced that you're not just as impulsively telling me I'm not going to hurt myself when just 60 seconds ago you said you were hopeless. So you do the emergency kind of things that you have to do, and if you catch them with a bottle of pills, or you catch them with a gun in their hand, or you take them to the hospital.
Yeah.
I would.
That's a done deal.
I would.
And that's the thing. I think many parents are afraid. I had a friend whose daughter talked about just some ideas that she had had about killing herself. The parent said, "We're going to the psychiatric hospital." And the child said, "Okay, I'll go pack."
Like, yeah, right. You know, yeah, thank God you brought it up. I was afraid to ask you for help. Sure.
So,
sure.
I mean, it's like the relief. What I keep finding out is they want us as parents to know. Whenever they drop like the teeniest hint, they're dying for us to ask more questions.
Sure.
So this is what you're saying. Don't worry about being overreactive. If this doesn't feel right to you, you know your child, take off for the ER if you need to.
I would much rather that your child knew that you overreacted, which is a testimony of love and sacrifice, than underreacted, which accidentally can look like, it's okay, I agree, I don't care. All the wrong messages that you want to give. Choose overreaction over underreaction every time.
Oh, that's great advice. Thank you. Now, some of the other things that we can look for are the discussing suicide or wanting to die, if somebody's got a plan. Obviously, somebody who has had a previous suicide attempt, they're much more at risk, correct?
Absolutely, and you can count the number. The greater the number, the greater the risk. One time matters. 23 times means a lot. They keep fiddling around with it until finally they get it right, either on purpose or accidentally. I've seen that before. So the number matters. So you ask, well, how many times have you been suicidal? I want to know. If they've known somebody who committed suicide, much less if they witnessed it, count that number too. Well, how many people have you ever known who did this? How many times have you ever talked to somebody else who said they were suicidal? All these things are numbers that add up.
And the giving away of personal possessions, that is beyond a plan. That is like the plan's already
that's part of the plan.
In
that's,
action.
That's part of the plan. I've made up my mind. I know what I'm going to do. And I'm going to make sure that somebody owns the things that are dear to me. And I'm going to give them away to the people that I want to have them. And the surprising other part of this is that you'll see them suddenly feel better. They've been moping around for weeks, but now they've made up their mind. Everything's going to be okay. They okay to them. They know what they're going to do. And so suddenly they're relaxed. They're brighter. The stress is off. You let down your guard. And the key here is it's too sudden. It's too easy. It's too quick. For a person who's been depressed for a month or two, and the next day they're better.
Like miraculous.
Yeah, right. That's a little scary.
And as parents, we want to see that. I think it's easy to overlook that as a signal that something's even more desperately wrong.
Yes. And so you ask, well, I'm glad you're better, but now convince me it's not just a flash in the pan, or that it's not because you've made up your mind to hurt yourself. I heard on Teens Talk Truth that could be a risk. You just tell them. I had a wonderful supervisor once that said, it doesn't matter how polished you are in your delivery if you're not right. The other side of that is, just be right. Who cares whether you fumble through it or not? You don't have to be a pro to blurt out, convince me. Tell me, do more. Help me out here. I love you. I just fumble with your words, stumble, blurt, stutter, whatever. But get out the fact that you want more.
And that's what I think is just so critical, because sometimes we don't ask because we don't want to know. But we have to know, otherwise our kids could be severely at risk. What about kids that appear to be happy? They have good grades. They have friendships. They go out. They socialize. So it's very difficult to see that these kids are depressed. And then all of a sudden, something triggers them to feel hopeless, sad, impulsive. What are some of the little clues in these kids that don't manifest the dropping grades, the sleeping more?
Well, first of all, they're going to be a surprise to everybody. They look like they got it together. So why suddenly are you worried about them? Why is anybody suddenly worried about them? What has happened? And you never know. These are the stressors that come out of the blue that nobody expected, that nobody knows about. Let me dream one up. This kid is doing great, has a wonderful life. Everything seems good. The parents don't know it, but he and the girlfriend or she and the boyfriend have been having sex. For whatever reason that nobody knows, one of them thinks they're HIV positive. Okay. Or one of them thinks that they've got a venereal disease. Or one of them thinks that something bad has happened or that they're pregnant. Okay.
Right.
That's the kind of thing that can pop up. And if a person has a parental, a home life, a situation where that would be
horrible
and life destructive, then suddenly, bam, you know, they're thinking suicide. Also, you got to remember that some depressions are just inherited. Look back in your own and your spouse's family history. How many people were now diagnosed in hindsight depressed? Were there any suicides in the past? Were there any mysterious car crashes that could have been suicidal? How many of them are alcoholic or addicted? Now that they're alive or dead, doesn't matter.
Right.
How many of them were self-medicating and became addicted? If you've got 14 people in the family that were alcoholic or addicted or depressed and had to be hospitalized, what's the chance that your child missed that gene? Bam, it's their age for that gene to be expressed. They're suddenly depressed, and here it comes. Get help.
So let's talk about that for a minute. Sometimes we overlook that, especially those of us who have backgrounds and family histories riddled with addiction, and we'd like to think, okay, everything's going to be fine now. My child is going to live a happy life, and all of that in the past doesn't matter. Can we talk about that genetic predisposition to depression specifically, or bipolar, or schizophrenia?
Sure. They're all related. Just because some doctor in the past decided that your great aunt was schizophrenic doesn't mean that that diagnosis was correct 20 years ago. We now know a lot more. Maybe they were depressed instead, or vice versa. But it doesn't matter. If you have any kind of history of mental illness or addiction or criminality, you got to understand that's another one that counts for mental illness. You know, how many uncles had to go to prison or jail that testifies towards addiction or something? Add all these up. And if you start to get a big number over 3 or 4 or 5, then it's time to say, son, daughter, you need to know this. We probably have a family history of difficulty. So you're going to have to be more careful than other people when you touch alcohol, drugs, cigarettes. You're going to have to be more careful about how you talk about your feelings and don't bottle things up. Or you're going to have to be more careful about being impulsive because that may have been something that you're just going to inherit. So you warn them about it, but watch out for it. Here it comes. I'm watching you. I want you to watch you. And you may dodge this bullet, but you may not. And if you've got that gene, it's not your fault. You're just going to have to be more careful than other people. The same thing as if you had heart disease in the family. You don't smoke, keep your weight down.
So how do alcohol and drug abuse play into the depression issue? Like a normal kid is going to probably experiment with drugs, experiment with alcohol, maybe once, twice, maybe not. If you have that genetic predisposition to depression, do you have that luxury of experimenting like other kids?
No, you don't. And there's a flip side to that, too. It reminds me of one of my learning points in my early career when I was in a psychiatric unit and was treating young alcoholic and addicts. And I happened to turn to one of the counselors and said, it just occurred to me, these people didn't get mad and drink. They drank and got mad. And the young recovering attendant said, well, yeah. I mean, he knew it all along. People don't know this. Drugs make you mean. And if you don't believe it, find somebody who smokes and hide their cigarettes or tear them up in front of them. You know, you'll see how mad that makes you. And that's just cigarettes. That's why people who do crack stand on street corners and shoot each other. Alcohol makes you angry and depressed. Anger, I insist that anger and sadness are just different sides of the same coin. Anything that made you mad, later on you realize was pretty sad. Anything that's sad, later on you're going to get mad about that it happened. It's just different sides of the same coin. And drugs make it worse, so they can create depression, much less anger. And by the way, suicide is an act of anger, not just sadness and desperation. And the proof of it is, look at any family who has been the victim of suicide. They're furious at the person who did that to them and then turned their back before they could reach out and get them to realize how much they loved them. It's an act of anger. You got to be pretty mad to want to kill somebody. You got to be really mad to want to kill yourself. So anger and sadness are different sides of the same coin. Drugs create it, much less make it worse. If it has started out as an anger or depression, and then you pour drugs on it, it's like gasoline on a fire. If you are predisposed to depression, the drugs can get that fire going. If you're not predisposed to either depression or addiction, but you keep fiddling with it, you're going to get it. There's a very rare 25% or less of the population that can be heavily exposed to addicting substances and not become addicted.
When you were talking earlier about the frontal lobe and how the alcohol and drugs affect the frontal lobe, is that temporary, or over time can that become permanent?
It depends on the drug. Alcohol, typically, you have a hangover the next day, and 2 days later, you're supposed to be better. But if you talk to any alcoholic, any old alcoholic, they'll tell you often they knew they weren't truly clean or sober for a year. They woke up a year after they'd been clean or sober and suddenly realized they were thinking differently. Their thinking was finally clear. So the hangover from it is long past whenever you can pick it up and demonstrate it in the bloodstream. On the other end of the spectrum, we know marijuana stays in your system detectably for at least 2 weeks and can have an effect that lasts months and months, if not up to, you know, a year.
Wow.
We have the rat brain slices that prove that it slows down the metabolism. The greatest quote was from my colleague Stephen Jaffe, a renowned psychiatrist here in Atlanta and around the country. And he quoted a patient of his who very smartly said, "Marijuana makes you stupid." He's right. You know, whatever. And that's what I tell kids. Look, it lowers your IQ. Now, if you're a genius and you want to spare some points, that's up to you. But if you're just average, you better leave it alone. It's going to make you, that's why people, kids mellow out. They get dumb. Hey, how are you? You know, I mean, you've ever listened to a high conversation. It's not very, erudite. So, and that lasts for months. So, you get a drop in grades and it won't fix right away, despite the fact they're studying. Maybe they just lowered their IQ. And all the other drugs are somewhere in between. And anybody can metabolize anything in any way. And you get two or more, it's going to slow down the metabolism of the other one. So you can't guarantee that just because it says in some textbook or some lab value that the cocaine is out of their system, well, is the effect out or not?
Right.
How do you know?
So if a parent finds out that their kid's been drinking, smoking pot, these might be clues that there's something going on, that they're not happy, they're depressed, that these kids could, if pushed in the right direction, end up being suicidal?
Yes.
Or is that a leap?
No, that's a warning sign. That's a clear danger sign. Why would you be happy and content and then do something risky? There's something wrong with that picture. Instead of, on the other hand, being happy and content and coming to the conclusion, I'm not doing anything to mess this up. This is wonderful. Okay? Which is what you would think a normal person would conclude.
Yes.
I'm not doing drugs. Look at what I got. Why would I risk everything that I believe in and look forward to, as opposed to making the opposite decision? Sure, it's a warning sign.
So that's like, I am not feeling right. I want to make myself feel better. Maybe it's depression. Maybe it's anxiety. Whatever it is, it's a signal something's not right.
It's a signal. Absolutely.
Now, one of the things in some of my research I turned up is that when kids think they're gay, they think they're bisexual, this may go back to what you were saying, if they're so afraid in their family that this could be a stressor beyond belief. Is it that, or is it something different?
Well, any stressor matters, and you don't know what a response is going to be. Obviously, your gender identity can be a horrible, tremendous stressor if you grow up in a community where you think that's going to be abhorrent. On the other hand, if you grow up in a community where that doesn't matter so much, then it's much less of a stressor, but it's still a stressor. If you take a self and notice I didn't say self-esteem, but a self that is fragile, you know, and a pimple on prom night is going to ruin everything. But if you take a person who is well-accomplished, smart, got all the other pieces in place, but has a major stressor, that could be an undoing. So all stressors count and should be explored and talked about. And again, directness invites directness. I always ask kids, at the point where I excuse the parents and say, okay, now it's me and the kid, and I warn them ahead of time this is going to happen. And I say, okay, let's get to the big questions that I have to ask you by yourself with the parents out of the room. Do you think you're gay? Slap. I just put it right out there. I want to know.
Good.
You know, do you think you have a venereal disease? Do you think you or your girlfriend's pregnant? Do you think that something's wrong with you? I just ask them. Here we go. You know, get ready, because here they come. I'm going to ask them. I want you to tell me the truth. And I tell them, if it's sensitive enough, either I'm not going to tell their parents, mm-hmm. or I'm going to tell them, this is serious enough that your parents have to know. Now, do you want me to tell them, or are you going to tell them? I'm not going to get left holding the bag. You don't keep dangerous secrets.
When have you ever had a kid just sit there and say, I'm not telling you anything? I mean, do you usually get the sense that something comes out of this exploration?
I guess I've always been satisfied. Let me put it another way. I have no memory of being, this kid is just lying to me right and left. I don't believe a thing they say. You know, I'm going to put them in the hospital for reasons I can't even say. I haven't had that happen.
And I guess this leads me back to what you were saying earlier, ask more. I think the kids want to know. One girl, when I interviewed her, I said, when you go out the door and you lie to your parents, how many times do you want to get caught? And she said, every time.
Absolutely. You got to use your gut here. And so you can say, I hear you. I know what you said. I'm still not entirely satisfied. I'm going to let you go. And I'm going to trust that you told me the truth, because you can lie to me, you know. You can con me. You can fool me if you want to. And I'm not an expert at knowing whether you're lying or not. I sure hope you're telling me the truth. But I just had to let you know I'm real nervous about this. And then they, you know, maybe you can get them to confess. But at least you didn't let on like, yeah, I believe everything you say, and I'm right, and you fooled me, and that, you know, there's the insult again. We don't have enough of a relationship for me to know. And you can get coached in this. If you have a question about your teen, you've tiptoed and waded in as deep as you can, but you're still not satisfied, and they won't go get help without a big row, doesn't mean you can't call. I've had parents do that. Somebody told me to call. I've got a son who I'm worried about this, that, or the other. What do I do? And I sit down and talk with them. Sometimes they come in. Sometimes I just do it over the phone and say, well, look, here's what I want you to try to do. And do it this way and for these reasons, much of what we're, you know, if not all of what we're talking about now. And I've coached the parents on interviewing techniques that'll make them feel better about being more direct with their teen.
And I think sometimes we get so like, oh, I want to do this perfectly. I don't want to say the wrong. I think sometimes you're right. You got to, like you said, blurt it out, stutter it out, whatever you do.
Absolutely.
But ask.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that I didn't elaborate on at the beginning is you're the author and producer of the book and the video Self and Self-Esteem, Is There a Hole in Your Bucket? And I know that you, which is available on teenstalktruth.com, by the way. I
know very much.
That this is your framework for a lot of your work, is that the self-esteem and the boundaries and that sort of thing can ultimately lead to destructiveness. Can you, in layman's terms, explain about that and how it applies to suicide or attempted suicide?
Well, I hope I can, because I think it's key. Whatever else suicidal ideation is composed of, it is an idea that says, make up your mind. Feel certain. Be action-oriented. Don't take no for an answer. It's only in the destructiveness that it's wrong. Those other elements we teach in business courses every day. We want that to happen. When you get someone to have that approach to life, it gives them a sense of self. The sad part is, some people have had their boundaries so constricted and crushed and damaged that they are reduced to trying to achieve a sense of self in the most primitive way, and that is by having to be destructive and suicidal and feeling whole and complete right before they die.
and that's their one time they really get that sense of self?
The only way that I've found to explain that is to understand that one of our venerable sources is wrong. Abraham Maslow says that you have a series of drives, and it starts with you want to breathe, then you want to drink, then you get hungry, then you want clothes, shelter, etc. And finally, self-actualization is the last and final drive. I think instead, self-actualization is the first and primary drive, and that's why we want to breathe and drink and eat. If you understand it that way, that explains why a person would face homicide or suicide in the face of a loss of a sense of self. It is that powerful a drive. Self drives everything, which means you would rather die than give up a sense of self. And if your self has been battered and abused enough, you will settle for death if you can achieve self first.
Do you think this applies across the board to all suicides?
I would. I have found it to be, and you make a statement like this that says always, you know somebody's going to find a reason that it isn't. An example would be, we know that somebody who's drunk can't make a good decision. How
right.
are you going to say that in a drunken stupor you were basing it on your sense of self? But if I'm correct, and I believe I am, that self is primary, then why would anyone else who has achieved most of a sense of self choose suicide? That's why I say self is always the issue and never self-esteem. Anybody who has achieved a sense of self, I can guarantee you they'll have something about that self that they can have esteem about. Everybody has some God-given talent, some God-given ability, some God-given appreciation of who they are. So that self-esteem is always the easy part. Self is the hard part. And if the experiences or the stressors have led to damage to that self, that's when a person, much less an inexperienced adolescent, will resort to the most primitive means to have a sense of self, even facing death.
Wow, that is so powerful. And it's such a different way of looking at mental health, at looking at families, at looking at human beings,
sure.
which is how important it is for us to keep those boundaries.
And eventually letting them go. The mental health is simple. It's mental illness that's complicated and convoluted. Who wrote the book, Everything I Ever Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten? He's right. It's simple. Mental health is simple. Another primitive way to try to have a sense of self is risky behavior or self-destructive behavior. I've treated adolescents who have cut on themselves numerous times, mm-hmm. numerous small cuts. And now you know and I know that a smart person knows that a little scratch on your skin is not going to kill you.
Right.
Was it suicidal? Can't be. That doesn't make any sense. What is it instead? It is the most primitive way that I can think of that says, I'm going to discover my boundaries. I'm trying to have a sense of self, so where do I end and where do I begin? Oh, there, where I see the blood, where I feel the cut. That's a boundary.
And is that why many times people who suicide, it's preceded by episodes of cutting?
Episodes of cutting or any kind of rebellious behavior. Let me think of the one thing I know my parents don't want me to do, and then I'll know where I end and where they stop. I'm going to go bungee jumping. I'm going to drive too fast. I'm going to break the law. What they're trying to do is to have a sense of self that they know is theirs, and that's not their parents.
Separate from who their parents are, what their parents want them to be, even from what their parents believe them to be.
Separate right? and individual, having a sense of self. The primary drive.
So ideally, if we're good parents, our kids won't do risky behaviors.
Yeah, exactly. Ideally, if we have said, well, I don't think that I want to do this, but if you want to do it, as long as you take precautions and you get training, if you want to jump out of an airplane with your birthday money, okay, I'll be there. I want to see it. We'll get it on film. Golly, it's going to scare me to death, and I love you. But wouldn't you rather have them do that or ride big, dumb animals or drive races that are controlled or join a shooting club or something that has danger written all over it but is properly trained and equipped and done in the right way so that they get to have a sense of self that is whole and complete so they won't go out and do it behind your back in a dangerous, illegal, risky way.
This is such great information, and I think there's so many parents that desperately need to hear this. So I cannot thank you enough for coming and sharing all of your experience, philosophies, premises with us today.
Well, you're quite welcome. It's been a pleasure for me, too. As I've said before, the goal of my life is to help more people, and I say it that way so that it'll never run out as a goal. And I told my wife on my tombstone, I wanted to say, I hope this is helping somebody. I've got some relatives who assure me that it will be, but it has been a pleasure and an honor, and I do hope that this helps somebody.
Thank you. Dr. Stephen Preece has been our guest today. If you would like to be in touch with him, you can call 770-602-0735. You can also get more information about his video book, Self and Self-Esteem, Is There a Hole in Your Bucket? By going to www.teenstalktruth.com. I'm Lisa Smith Henderson, your host for Teens Talk Truth, and I'm very happy to have as my guest today Gabe, who's willing to tell us his story. He attempted suicide less than a year ago, and he's doing much, much better, and here to share a story and hopefully enlighten some parents about some of the signs and what we can look for. So welcome, Gabe.
Hey, how are you?
I'm glad you lived.
Me too.
So, Gabe, now you're 18, right? What, did you have a happy family life?
Yeah, in younger years, but the older I got, I guess I just got an attitude and wasn't doing as good in school. And
so are your parents still together?
It's my stepdad, my mom, but yeah, they're still together.
But your biological father?
I don't talk to him too much.
So he's not really in the picture.
Mm-mm.
When did your parents split up?
When I was like 2 or 3, I think.
Okay, so he was never really part of the
no.
of the picture. And did you have a good relationship with your stepdad?
Not at first, but like lately. We got better because he had cancer or whatever, and that's kind of brought our family together. Like him being sick and everything.
Was he a good dad to you? I mean...
Yeah, he's got me everything I wanted and gave me a house and food. Like, so, it's way more than my real dad. My real dad does anything for me.
So your parents are they're happy together?
Yeah.
So you wouldn't say you grew up in a... Were you abused?
No. I can think of like 5 spankings I've had.
So no, you weren't beaten or anything. Were your parents alcoholics or drug addicts?
Mom drinks a little bit, and sometimes she'll take it a little bit too much, but that's like maybe once or twice a month, so that's not really a problem.
Okay, so basically, I guess what I'm trying to establish here is you didn't grow up in a very troubled family. And let me ask you this, does anybody in your family suffer from depression?
My aunt, she's a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
Like, she's on all kinds of pills and medication. She's pretty much depressed, I guess you'd say.
Yeah. So there is some history of it in your family.
Yeah.
What began to happen in your downward spiral? We've talked a little bit, and you'd said your grades got to be bad.
Yeah, and that just, like...
But was that because you were depressed or because you were using drugs and alcohol, or did... What happened there?
Yeah, drugs and alcohol, probably, and then I got a little bit lazy, pretty much quit doing everything. And started, like, failing all my classes.
So that would be one of the first things that somebody would look at, maybe. Like, hey, my child, all of a sudden, you were doing well,
yeah.
And then, bam, you started doing badly.
Mm-hmm.
Did your parents think anything was wrong?
No, they just always told me I need to work harder. But, like, I'd never be home, so I could never do that. And
you're 18 now. When did this start?
Last year when I was 17.
Okay, so this didn't take very long for you to spiral down quickly then.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Were you getting depressed as you were drinking and using, or?
I know that probably made it worse, but this home life was getting bad, and me and my girlfriend were always, like, grappling and getting in fights and stuff.
So what was bad about your home life? What changed?
Just, like, when I started doing bad, like, they just yell at me all the time, and I wouldn't do anything, like, help out around the house, or, and they just got fed up with me.
So your parents... got angry. They just thought you were doing bad on purpose, do you think?
Yeah, probably, because they know I don't really try too much. And they just kept on trying to get me to do better and better. And that made me start fighting with them.
And so you had a girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And things weren't going that well there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what precipitated the attempt?
Yeah, pretty much.
So what happened? What did that... Give me that 48 hours leading up to the attempt. What happened?
I don't know, like the night or two before, like I was told I needed a break. And she goes and gets drunk or at a friend's house, calls saying all kinds of just random, crazy, mean stuff or whatever. She comes over the next morning, and she's still like that.
Still kind of drunk and mean?
Yeah, just like off-the-wall stuff she's saying. And that on top of my parents, I wasn't getting along with them too good at the time. And then her, I couldn't take it anymore. I was tired of everything, and I just wanted to end it.
Did this happen, like, pretty quickly, though, where you thought, I can't take it? Like,
yeah.
So that was a pretty short period of time.
Yeah.
So what did you do?
I just got a razor out of the cupboard or whatever and just started cutting it.
Let me ask you this. The razors that you had, were they the straight edge razors?
Yeah.
And was that something that was in the house just like for shaving, or did you have them there for that idea in mind?
I think we're just like cutting open boxes, like for box cutters.
All right. So they weren't just small little razors, like an X-Acto knife kind of thing,
yeah,
or a box cutter. Okay. So this was more serious.
Mm-hmm.
Where you cut what?
On my wrist.
Your wrists?
Yeah.
And what happened?
I don't know. It was bleeding pretty good for a minute or whatever. And then she'd already came over like twice that morning. I guess she was coming over to apologize or something. And I opened the door and like she saw it on my wrist and she just like busted the door down. And she called people to come over because she wanted to like hold me down so I couldn't get it again. And
get the razor again?
Yeah. And then my cousin came over and he called the ambulance and they came and got me and took me to the hospital.
Were you sorry that she came over and caught you? Or were you relieved?
I was kind of mad at the time, but thinking back, I'm really glad they did come.
How far, I mean, were you starting to bleed out pretty
badly?
Yeah,
it'd been like 30 minutes after I did it, and that's when they called ambulance.
So when they got you to the hospital, what happened?
I can't remember if they stitched my wrist up or not, but they just put me in this little room, and then they called a mental hospital or whatever,
mm-hmm,
and they came and got me that knot at like 12 and took me there.
So they took you to a psychiatric hospital?
Yeah.
And what, put you on suicide watch?
I don't really call it suicide watch. They didn't put me in the room that had a camera because I was pretty mellowed out by then.
You were angry, though, at this point.
Yeah, I was really mad when I got there.
Mad because she intervened, mad because you're in the hospital.
Just a little bit of all that because I didn't want to be there.
Was that a turning point for you, Gabe?
After about that second day in the psychiatric hospital, I was, because like I listened to some of these kids' stories, and I was just like, oh, my God, like, mine's nothing compared to theirs, like, the stuff they deal with. I just think back, and it's like, how stupid I was to try that, and after all these people go through what they do.
I guess what I want to know, like, as a parent, what could we have looked for? Tell me, like, what would you have liked for your parents to have done, and what would you like for them to have seen that showed you were, like,
well,
spiraling down?
It made me more mad, but, like, they just let me go out, and I pretty much did what I wanted, and I was getting child support money, so I'd just go blow all it on whatever I wanted. I don't know, not letting your kids go out as much, like.
So they gave you too much freedom?
Yeah. And then, like, not knowing where I was at.
They didn't know where you were, didn't make you accountable.
No.
Gave you too much money to spend.
Yeah.
And so you just kind of didn't have a lot of real clear boundaries. Like, this is when you need to be home. Who are you going with? Where are you going to be? That sort of thing?
Yeah, I didn't really have any boundaries on what I could on what not to do.
Okay, so that's one thing you would like. That's really clear. So you would have liked more boundaries. And then what about do you feel like you were in a depression?
I didn't at the time when it all started, but the more I got, like, heavier in the drugs and the alcohol, like, I guess I could see it more because I just started drinking, like, every day and every night, school nights, whatever, I didn't care.
The drinking was, I'm sure it makes you feel more depressed, too, to begin with, because it's a central nervous system depressant. And did your parents not have any idea you were drinking like that?
No.
So you hid it pretty well?
Yeah. I just wait till they go to sleep because they go to sleep early. So about 10 o'clock, open up that bottle.
And then did you get up and go to school the next morning?
Yeah.
You did. So you went to school, but your grades were bad.
Yeah.
Okay. So they fussed at you about your grades being bad. What could they have done differently?
I don't know. I guess just give me more like rules on what not to do and, I don't know, call my teachers, make them bring my homework home or something.
Did they ever sit down with you and say, hey, what's really going on? Like, why are you messing up in school? You used to be a good student.
No, like, when I was at the hospital after that happened, like, Mom, she's like, she didn't know what was going on. And she's like, what'd you do this for?
So your mother was shocked.
Yeah.
She must have been heartbroken, too. I'm sure to see your child laying there like that's got to be very scary. What's happened since then? Do you still live at home?
Yeah.
So how are things different for you at home now?
Well, I quit doing drugs, but like I still drink a little bit, not nowhere as much. And like I try to get along with my parents more, do stuff for them around the house, and try helping pay stuff sometimes. like bills a little bit.
It's helped your relationship with your parents.
Yeah.
Then. I mean, that's pretty big. And you did that without any kind of psychiatric help?
Mm-hmm. I guess that being in the psychiatric hospital was because we'd all tell each other stories. So doing that just gave me a little bit of feel for everything.
Do you feel like now that this has happened to you and you're not in therapy?
No.
No, you don't take any kind of antidepressant medications or anything like that. Do you feel like if this started to happen again and you could feel yourself sort of spiraling down, do you think you would, what kind of steps would you take?
I guess I'll ask mom, take me back to the psychologist if he'd help any.
So you have a greater relationship with your mother now. So you could go to her and say that.
Yeah, closer, yeah. I didn't talk to mom about anything now.
So less than a year later, your whole family life's turned around.
Yeah.
Did they seem more involved with you now? Do you think that sort of threat of losing you?
Yeah, I guess I'd say like more involved. Like we have a place on the river in Alabama. They asked me to go there a whole lot more and try to take me to dinner with them and everything like that more often.
One of the things that's come up, Gabe, in all of these interviews that I've done with teens is what kids want is more time with their parents.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your experience?
Like at the time I didn't, but now I think about, yeah, I love being with my parents.
And so now you're spending time with them. You guys have a better relationship.
Yeah.
And what about school? Did you graduate?
No, I didn't graduate. I just have to go back another semester and I'll be done.
Great. So are you going to work this time or?
Yeah. I'm going to work this time.
Yeah. Well, I am so glad that your girlfriend, even though you were mad at her at the time, came in and found you.
Yeah.
That's really, really incredible. And I thank you for talking to me. It's been very difficult to find somebody who was willing and able to talk about this subject. And I think parents desperately need to know.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a bunch, Gabe.
All right, you're welcome.
As we've learned in the previous interviews, there is a connection between drugs and alcohol and depression. Sometimes the depression leads to the drug and alcohol abuse, and sometimes the depression is a result of usage or is a result of stopping the usage. Cocaine tends to have a serious rebound effect. You feel great while you're doing it, and then you slip into a depression when coming down. Now, in the course of a Teens Talk Truth interview about drugs and alcohol, I spoke to a young woman about the depression that set in when she quit using cocaine. Here's what Paris had to say.
When I stopped doing cocaine and I hit that bottom low, I don't ever want to go back there again. I've never felt more depressed.
Have you ever gone to counseling or thought about doing that?
I told my mom, I was like, Mom, I feel like I'm getting really depressed. I feel like I need a counselor or something. And she was like, you're not depressed. Because I think people are like, that's definitely happens on TV. That doesn't happen to me.
Do you think it's the same attitude that parents have? My kid's not drinking. My kid's not depressed.
Yeah, I do.
So
it can't happen to me type attitude.
If we look at this, if we look at the behavior in our children, we've got to look at ourselves.
Right.
Something is not right here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard.
Yeah, it's really hard.
So if a child says to a parent, I'm depressed and I want to see a therapist, get them to a therapist.
That's what I think.
Or if they say, I'm depressed. To me, if a child says, I want to go get help, then that's really a cry for help.
Exactly. And I think even noticing patterns of kids like locking themselves in their room or not really talking a whole lot, I can understand puberty, kids locking themselves in their rooms, being mean to you and stuff like that. But I think if you talk to them and you're like, hey, like, people always make counselors and therapists out to be people that really, like, for people that really need it and stuff. But, you know, it'd be awesome for you to have someone to talk to. You'd really like it. And, like, I'm just going to ask you if you want to, like, say, like, I've had friends that had them before. And it just, you know, it's nice to have someone to talk to. Maybe, like, that instead of saying, you need therapy.
Yeah, like,
it's kind of like, yeah, exactly. It kind of scares the kid. And you're like, what are you trying to say? Something wrong with me?
So you offer it as a means of support. Paris, thank you so much for sharing your strength, your hope and experience, and enlightening parents as to what is really going on in our world today that sometimes we have a hard time with.
Sure, absolutely.
This is Lisa Smith Henderson, your host for Teens Talk Truth. And if you'd like to get copies or more information about Teens Talk Truth, please go to teenstalktruth.com.